This is the One Thing Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Adam Rindy. The One Thing Podcast brings together leaders in functional and naturopathic medicine to discuss actionable information that may unlock puzzles in the areas of gut health, brain health, metabolism, and longevity. Please note, these episodes do not replace the opinion of your doctor. They are not intended to diagnose or treat any condition. Please discuss this information with your provider and discuss your own unique personal health history before adapting this information. Please subscribe to our episodes so that you can stay on top of the most current information in these areas of medicine. Hey everybody, Dr. Rindy here. Welcome to this week's episode of the One Thing Podcast. It's really interesting to be back with this current episode. Very timely. So many people are struggling with changes in their mental health this time of year, with changes in weather, changes in seasons, and always wondering, why is this happening during certain times of the year? And the immune system is doing funny things this time of year, and many other changes in activity, changes in weather, changes in light. So lots to think about. When thinking about the immune system and mental health, I couldn't think of a better person to have on than our guest, Dr. Emily Gutierrez, who I met through Intellix DNA. She's an expert in understanding how nutrition interfaces with the immune system and mental health. So she looks at genetics, nutrition, and how they impact people's mental function, specifically in conditions of neurodiversity, ADHD, anxiety, depression, autism, pandas. She knows her stuff with these areas. And in this episode, she really painted a really good structure to think about how to interface with mental health through balancing the immune system and looking at different drivers of the immune system. And interesting enough, neurotransmitters such as glutamate seem to be a big player in this world of mental health. And we talk deeply about that, which genetics are involved with activating the immune system, what environmental triggers are also involved with activating the immune system and its impact on mental health. She has a lot of amazing experience. She's got all the pedigrees that you would want in a practitioner as far as her education. She's affiliated with Johns Hopkins University, is advanced in functional medicine and pediatric nursing. I think you'll really see and hear an expert at work when we discuss this topic. This episode was recorded over video, and we are referencing a slideshow. So I encourage you to also watch this on YouTube if you're not doing that already. And also you can listen in on the podcast as well in the audio version. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. Please subscribe and like to my channel and forward this to the many people who are struggling with trying to understand the puzzle of mental health. So without further ado, welcome to this episode of the One Thing Podcast. Dr. Gutierrez, welcome to the One Thing Podcast. I'm so delighted to be here with you.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So we met through Intellix DNA and some of the coursework that you teach there. And it's just been really great learning from you. And I'm excited about our topic today and the things that we were planning on talking about. I just would love to get started hearing, first off, like all the things that you're involved with, because you do quite a bit, and it would be great just to kind of learn kind of what that looks like. What is your daily life consist of, and all the different things and projects you're involved with?
Well, I do have my hands in a few different pots, that's for sure. My primary right now is I do have a pediatric functional medicine practice in Austin, Texas. We've been open for about a decade. And so I have a busy private practice. I also am a co-owner of a supplement company, Neuronutrients. So lots of work goes into that with formulation and all of the things. It's definitely been more work than I anticipated when we started, but it's actually been really good. And then, of course, I'm a mom and I have two kids, one that's a young adult and one that's an older teenager. And I'm married and I have a couple of really naughty beagle dogs that require some work every now and then. So,
yeah.
I also teach some. I teach some at the University of Texas at Austin. Sometimes I'll be a guest speaker. And then I'm adjunct faculty at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. So I teach on integrative and functional medicine to their nurse practitioners. And that's pretty awesome because they get content that is so different than everything that they're learning. And I really, really enjoy that because really one of my core missions in life is how can we bring this type of information to people that are learning how to manage patients? Just some of the core things that are so important for health and longevity.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, and along those lines, how far back does your journey to integrative and functional medicine go? What was some of the early sparks to that?
Well, probably like most of us that are in this field, it's through pain and suffering that I found this. And the first real time of pretty intense suffering in my life was postpartum. And I say that with also holding the space for it was the best decision I ever made to have a baby. And I don't regret it for one nanosecond. But healing from pregnancy and postpartum was really, really, really tough on my mental health. I had depression and even a touch of postpartum psychosis. And, you know, it was really discovering all the things that helped me really get out of it and not only get out of it temporarily, but stay out of it. So I went on a big journey of learning what else besides psychiatric medication could get me back to balance and to the best mental health I could possibly have.
Mm. And were you already a healthcare provider at that time?
I was. Definitely wow. Was. But I, you know, it was 20 years ago. So the depth and breadth of my knowledge of what I know now is so wildly different. I would say I know 90 to 95% more today than I did then.
Mm-hmm. And did you grow up in traditional medicine, kind of with a traditional medicine viewpoint, or did you have some early influences in integrative or natural medicine, functional medicine?
I would say I grew up in more traditional, definitely more traditional. In fact, you know, my undergraduate, my graduate, and my doctoral degree are very, very allopathic schools. And I say allopathic in concert with traditional.
Yeah.
I live in Austin, and we like to keep it weird here. That's the city. So I, you know, when I first went into practice delivering primary care to pediatrics, I would have a lot of parents that challenged me a lot on what I was asked, you know, I was telling them to do or advising them to do. And so much to where there were times I didn't want to go into a room because it was a well check with a family that was going to question me about vaccines and ask me about essential oils and vitamins. And I was so woefully unequipped to have those conversations. All I felt was defensive and not collaborative. So when I got to Johns Hopkins, my doctorate is in translational medicine, which basically from what we know to how we practice, how can we improve outcomes? Because the gap of knowledge to translation into practice is, you know, about two decades at least. So my problem was I didn't know how to deal with all of my tree hugging, oil rubbing, crunchy parents. So
yeah,
I needed one on a journey of really how to bridge that gap and do it scientifically. Looking at a little bit of the woo, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's Austin and Seattle, I think where I live, share that in common. You know, the patient population is looking for a wide array of answers to their health. And, you know, it's like, yeah, the patients push us to learn and grow and stretch and find other answers.
Yes, I love it that you said that, because I think really good providers, their patients are some of their best teachers. If we're willing to listen and not think, oh, we're the provider, we should know it all. We're right and you're wrong. But if we can really listen and hear what they're saying and take in their experience and collaborate and do our own scientific research, I mean, it is really what leads to the best outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we dive into more about talking about mental health and the immune system, and I'd love to just sort of frame this conversation, because I think there's some reverence that goes around any discussion about mental health. You know, it's like some people are only, you know, especially parents with kids that are specially abled or various other challenges, might just have their hands completely full, and they hear a talk with all these new solutions, and it just can be like, oh my goodness, I just need to find a way to have to feed my child breakfast or get them dressed today. Can we just frame this just sort of like the context of the world that we're about to discuss, and how challenging it is, and how much we, you know, how much that is seen and understood?
Yes, I'm glad that you're bringing that to light, because we're about to get pretty sciencey for sure.
Yeah.
And what the parents want to know at the end of the day is, what can I do at home? What are steps can I make? And really, hopefully, some parents will just shift their mindset and their framework of potentially things that could be contributing to dysfunction. So hopefully we will keep it to where we feel like there's some actionable things that parents can do, or at least things that can be on their mind as they're thinking through their child's or their own chronic illness.
Yeah. And I think along those lines is, there are going to be waves of times and stages where you can do more or less, and just having a way to organize the information and keep it somewhere too, just for reference, so that you can nibble at it as you go. I mean, I think that's the best we can ask when we're trying to deal with challenges, is, you know, to kind of nibble away at it and use it and use information. But what I find is people learn and then they forget where they put what they learned. So it's always good just to kind of have like a special file or a place where you can go back to information and review it because there's just so much coming at people these days.
Yes, definitely. I agree wholeheartedly.
Well, great. Well, if you could share with us how mental health is, just from a big picture standpoint, how mental health is influenced by the immune system and vice versa, you know, just kind of paint that picture. Because a lot of people think, oh, mental health, take this medication to stabilize it or what have you. And the discussion stops there. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're anxious, take this, you're depressed, take this, you have a kind of a neurodiverse presentation, there's this medication, and it's like, okay, well, there's the solution. Let's see how it goes. Let's talk about kind of the underworld of mental health and how the immune system kind of plays a role. If you could set that up for us.
Yes. Well, the monoamine hypothesis of depression is quickly going away. And what that means is, it's not all about a lack of serotonin or too much or too little dopamine. In most every chronic disease, most of us, no matter what field or genre of medicine that you're in, will agree that inflammation that goes aberrant or is not regulated can cause chronic disease. And the brain is not, especially the brain, is not excluded from that. So when our immune systems have stress on them, and it, we get stress from multiple different factors, and we'll go through some of that. But when it gets stress, and that stress is not quickly resolved in a way that brings us back to homeostasis or our balance, that stress can cause inflammation in the brain, and the brain then can have some remodeling and reworking of how the networks are going and what presentation you have. And, you know, as far as depression, unfortunately, we know that about 30% of people respond to antidepressants. And if you're put on them, which I prescribe them, I'm not 100% against them, that you're likely to have a response at first, and then they don't work as well. And you might need a higher dose, which might mean that you have a higher side effect profile, and then they just may quit working at all. And if that's our only solution for depression, we're in trouble, because a lot of people struggle with their mental health. And hopefully this talk will help people put into context that the immune system is part of that picture. It's not reductionistic the way that it's one pill for one ill, or, you know, if you have ADHD, here's your stimulant. It's so much more complex than that.
Yeah, and you've been so generous to provide us a slideshow today, you know, or kind of some images to look at as we learn and talk. So I'm really looking forward to that. And those of you who are listening to this on the podcast audio, you'll be able also to find the presentation or slides on on YouTube. And so we're going to be talking through these. And so if we're referring to some images, you can kind of follow up on YouTube and watch that as well. So I'm going to share sort of this overview that you've provided for us, and you can kind of start talking about that, the kind of more big picture things about how systems biology fits into this topic.
So we're going to zoom out here a little bit just so you get the context with how I think about health in general. And I believe that our systems are always talking and interacting. And when you have dysfunction in one system, it can affect the other. A lot of people have heard the gut-brain connection, and that's one. It's the gut talking to the brain, and there's a mechanism for that. But when I look at a child or a young adult or an adolescent, I look at them and I think, okay, there's five big things that I'm thinking about. And the first is, you know, what are they? What was the genetic risk coming into the situation? And we all have variants in our genes. I'm sure you guys have talked some about genes on this podcast, and none of us are born with zero variants or genetic mutations. We all have them. And they do set us up for risk of certain things depending on where those variants are. So our genes kind of set the stage. And then how we feed our body to grow our body, especially when we're a baby, a toddler, an adolescent, how we are growing our body is so very important, because nutrition, which, you know, I cannot ever give a talk without talking about nutrition, because it's such a basic fundamental.
Yeah. And
nutrition isn't just about macros and calories. It's about energy balance. It's about giving our body what it needs to have certain processes work in our body. And our nutrition is put into our gut. And that's another pillar, because if your gut has dysfunction in it, whether it be that you have, you know, an overgrowth of harmful bacteria, or you have a lot of inflammation, or you're honestly just not feeding your gut things that it isn't reactive to and isn't allergic or sensitive to, then there's a whole host of things that can happen from that. And your gut is also known as your second brain, and also known to be the biggest player in your immune system. And your immune system is always trying to defend what is coming into your body, repair it, and keep it in that homeostatic balance and lower the inflammation. Not all inflammation is bad, but inflammation that is uncontrolled can have a deleterious effect. It can be very harmful to our body. Mm-hmm. And while in, you know, traditional medicine, we're only taught about lead levels above 5 and like super terrible, harmful toxicity that's pretty rare. We're not really taught about all the toxicity that's a low-lying amount in our communities, in our homes, in our environments every day. And toxicity burdens our immune system as well. Different types, what you're breathing, what you're putting on your skin, what you're ingesting, what you're swallowing, what you're drinking. So toxicity plays a big role, because also whatever you ingest that's toxic, that's burdening your immune system, you have to eliminate. And mm-hmm. elimination plays into that as well. So the 5 pillars are really your genetic risk. How are you balancing your energy with nutrition? How's your gut functioning? What's your immune system doing or playing a role in that? And how is your total toxic burden? And anyone, we have to have that in context around what we're not going to get into a lot today, which is what's your family system? What's your past trauma? What is your social and emotional life like? The whole psychology of the human is so fascinating, and it's in the center of that. And that always has to be taken into context.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like this flow, because it's, you know, being grounded in nutrition, because, you know, that's such a foundation of way that we interface with our health, you know, hopefully every 3 to 4 hours, you know, we're thinking about fuel or what have you. And some people might be less or more, what have you. But it's just really nice, because a lot of people are so confused when they're struggling with like a puzzle as to like where to start. You know, it's just such a challenge. And if you start in a place that you're not ready for, it might make things worse. And so I think so let's talk about that.
it is such a foundational piece, you know, even from the first day of life, when you're exposed to formula or mother's milk, it's a foundational piece to how your microbiome establishes, you know, where you colonize through the vaginal canal. If you were fortunate enough to do that, then did you, you know, if you were drinking mother's milk, you know, what was her total toxic burden going into those first days of breastfeeding and those first months and years? So nutrition is just, it is literally what sets up our foundation for health. And, you know, people that don't believe that nutrition is important, you just have to ask them one simple question. You know, what happens if you don't eat? We die. Mm-hmm. It's really important. And it's more complicated than just the keto diet or, you know, the gluten-free, dairy-free diet. There's a lot of things about nutrition that are very specific to the individual. And for kids especially, they have selective eating, otherwise known as picky eaters. And then the density, their nutritional density can be very, very weak. You know, you can have a very overfed and undernourished child. In fact, you know, I have a kiddo that is not, you know, growing very well, but very overweight. And the, you know, eventually he saw endocrinology, and they were just like, there's no way you have celiac disease. And we did a panel, and it lit up like a Christmas tree, because they couldn't conceptualize that this child is overweight, but has malabsorption issues at the same time. But it's really just the diet and what they were eating, you know? So also, we have to put into context that nutrition is one thing, but how you absorb it in your gut is absolutely another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're working with a lot of children, and, you know, kind of you're talking in that previous sample about limited diets and what have you. So, what do you see as the common nutrient deficiencies?
Well, this is actually very, very robustly reported in the literature. So, and I see it in clinical practice over and over and over again. Like the more you do this, the more it's, you think, well, do I even really need a lab? Because I can absolutely kind of predict where this child is at. And we see that a lot of people are deficient in iron, zinc, magnesium, fatty acids, B vitamins, and vitamin D. So the way that you can tell this is certainly through serum testing, looking at labs, but even nutritionally on an exam, you can look at nails, mm-hmm. if they have those white spots, any like ridging, brittle nails. Iron deficiency is so common in a growing child, a menstruating woman, or just, you know, a vegan or people that don't really eat a lot of iron rich foods. So there's just really a lot of common deficiencies you see. And all of these things that we're talking about have a role in the immune system. All of them do.
So. Yeah. And, you know, in specially able populations or what have you, I mean, there's so many challenges with nutrition. So I think, you know, the texture, smell, taste, which is a whole other podcast kind of topic, but, you know, I just think it's important to realize that it's not the parents' fault or that they're being bad parents or, you know, in some case, there's kind of a balance between ownership of what we buy at the store and trying foods and challenging foods and various other things, but there needs to be some special care in some patients. Is that correct?
Yes. Parents have to realize that you are not responsible for what your child eats. You are responsible for what you provide them to eat.
Yeah.
So if you just give up and get Takis and Dr. Pepper because they're going to, you know, that's really on you. They're a child, but I understand the vulnerability of wanting to provide that and not having the hassle of the tantrum. And I truly believe more and more of this work that I'm doing, I just believe that selective eating has a lot to do with neuroinflammation. And I really think it's more of an OCD pathway. And that's why I feel like I've seen a lot of good results when we really start to address the OCD and the inflammation, the picky eating gets better. And zinc is one of those that's known. If you're zinc deficient, it has a lot of similarities to anorexia nervosa. So zinc alone can change the way that food tastes. But yes, an immune system, a nervous system that has a lot of sensory sensitivity to it, the textures, the feels, the smells of the food, kids are going to have more trouble with it typically. But it's not hopeless. You can change it as you get into the work.
I love that framework, just from a standpoint of knowing and having some empowerment of how to think about those situations and, you know, thinking about OCD or anxiety. And, you know, we have so many tools to support those conditions, even though they're very challenging, at least, you know, just throwing out the term as, you know, I have a picky eater or, you know, my child's averse to eating, knowing that those are some of the roots of it is really helpful. Thanks for pointing that out. It's good. And I know learning about the ins and outs of zinc too has been really helpful too, about how it interfaces with our neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What are some of your thoughts about genetic vulnerability or genetic risk for having immune dysregulation?
There are some people that have genetic variants that make pathogen exposure more vulnerable to their immune systems and therefore brains. For example, you know, there are variants and pathways, a lot in the literature, you're going to read about tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin 6. Maybe the one you were referring to is the MBL2 or something called mannosmyelin-lectin 2. And this one's really interesting because it's a gene that actually you can recognize that there's proteins on the surfaces of cells. And those proteins are, you know, recognizing viruses and bacteria and fungi and yeast. And once our immune system really recognizes that there's an infection there, it can activate the lectin pathway, which is part of our complement system and our immune system. So it helps us to get rid of infection and to control inflammation from it. So if you have one of these variants in your mannose binding lectin 2, you're less likely to recognize that there's a pathogen there, and you're more likely to have inflammation that's uncontrolled, and you're more at risk for something called an encephalopathy, which means you have an infection and then later you have a brain inflammation from that infection. Wow. Also known as autoimmune encephalopathy.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, for people who are new to polymorphisms or genetics and all these the terms that we're talking about. So, you know, just in basic terms, you know, we all having this these risk factors would mean that for example, someone might be more at risk for promoting or pushing out more tumor necrosis factor alpha, and then vice versa, the other mannose binding lectin 2 more at risk for producing more of that. And so TNF-alpha is something that, you know, we're seeing a lot with post-COVID syndromes and other conditions like elevation of that. What's it feel like to have TNF-alpha up, like in your body? Is it, do you have sort of a way that you can sense it and clinically?
Well, if I'm fortunate enough to be able to draw blood on someone, I can see it in their blood. And remember, I'm seeing it in their serum or their peripheral blood and not in their brain.
Right.
Often when someone has an elevation of this inflammatory or pro-inflammatory molecule or cytokine, you're going to see things like motor tics, vocal tics, or both, obsessional thinking, more of the autoimmune encephalitis I talked about, which can be that in itself has kind of a basket of symptoms like selective eating. You can have a lot of separation anxiety. You can have a regression in actually being able to control your bathroom, like either wetting the bed or having urinary accidents during the day. So often we'll see that it's an inflammation, but in research we've shown when they look at studies, they look at the brain in vivo, in vitro, in humans, you know, tumor necrosis factor alpha is a little cytokine or inflammation molecule that really can get through that blood-brain barrier. So when it's activated, a whole host of things happen. And I think we're going to get in a little bit more to that. But the next one is interleukin 6.
Yeah, that's one that's mentioned so much in chronic inflammatory conditions, and I'd love to kind of just hear your rundown on interleukin 6.
It's interesting. The study that I put on the slide there, they looked at a very, very large cohort of people. And their hypothesis was, you know, does interleukin 6 and high variance in the brain actually remodel the brain? And what they found was there is less gray matter in the brain and more cortical thickening in the brain. So we know interleukin 6 is another one of those inflammatory molecules that can get through the brain and really stimulate the microglia, which is the immune cells of the brain. And this has been associated with things like vascular dementia, autism, and schizophrenia over and over again.
Okay. And so there's, going back to the beginning of our discussion, we had talked about how there's these different areas or systems to balance. And so the gut and the brain have this interface, and how do you see the gut playing a role in this mental health picture?
The gut is one of the sayings in functional medicine, I'm sure you know, is where you don't, if you don't know where to begin, begin in the gut.
Yeah.
And why is that? Is that because people are putting inflammatory things into the gut? Is that because there's an imbalance of bacteria in the gut? Really, when I think about the gut to the immune system to the brain, I think a lot about dysbiosis. And dysbiosis means you have a flora or a type of bacteria in there that's not beneficial to human health. And in fact, these strains of bacteria often are gram-negative bacteria, and they can emit something called a lipopolysaccharide. And when you have more of this like kind of inflammation from these gut bugs, it can really make your gut more leaky or increase intestinal permeability. And it can also just that inflammation gets into your body, and then that inflammation can get into your brain. So the translocation of that inflammation from the gut becomes systemic, and then it really just upregulate autoimmunity or kind of flip that switch to autoimmunity. So when we talk about balancing the gut for the brain, it's important to understand what is your microbiome garden look like. And I really think that we're getting better at doing that. I don't think we've nailed it as far as like knowing 100% what's in your microbiome.
Right.
And I don't know if you experience this with your patients, but sometimes you can find a lot of gram-negative flora and they're asymptomatic or have no symptoms. What do you find?
Yeah, I do. And so I think about either one of two scenarios is that inflammation is kicking up another system's inflammation. So a lot of those patients I'll see will have skin disorders or like an eczema or psoriasis that's going on, and they're like, my gut's fine, because there's more front page news than the gut. There's, you know, that once the skin is involved, a lot of other things lose focus because that's such a debilitating process to go through. And then I also sometimes think, well, maybe the barrier is really healthy, and that particular person might be stabilizing all that LPS at this moment, because they might have a good healthy gut barrier with good mucus, and maybe they're just not, it's not breaking at that point.
Yeah, and there's the test zonulin, right, that maybe you could do to see alongside this. But all that testing it gets expensive for the patient, and it's not really in our mainstream labs like LabCorp and Quest. Have you ever run a zonulin from those mainstream labs?
I haven't seen it offered. At least stool zonulin I haven't. I haven't checked for serum zonulin. I usually have to order a special lab, like C-Rex or someone like that, to get some good zonulin markers.
That's right. I hope it's, to me, that's the translational gap right there, is that we are not offering that to the masses. It's not like an annual screening is how high is your zonulin. Because I think that, you know, zonulin is one of the proteins that breaks down when the gut barrier has integrity issues. And we can measure it in blood and stool. But I would argue that it might be as important as a cholesterol panel in some.
Yeah, and I think we're getting some really good ways to use all of the proteins that are involved with gut permeability, you know, the ones that we know, like occludin and zonulin. And it's just fascinating to figure out, you know, this intestinal barrier piece. It's sort of, I think, always a question of what came first. Is the intestinal barrier what's driving the problem, or is the upstream problem driving the intestinal barrier issue? So it's very tricky to kind of find out where to start. But like in a case like this, like gut brain axis, don't you think like starting that both systems need to be supported to support each other? It's a two-way relationship, right?
Yes, the bi-directional communication of the gut and the brain, absolutely. So it's hard to know what is the chicken and what is the egg in this situation, sure. And of course, there's infection. You know, sometimes I'll see a white blood cell count on a patient that's 8 or 9. And typically, the lab value is at least greater than 10 to really think about systemic inflammation in the blood. But it's just elevated enough that when I go and look at the gut, there's all the infection. There's where I see it. I've even seen infection in the nose, like strep throat in the nose. So the truth is we're all going to get infected all of our lives for the rest of our lives. And that's okay. In fact, the earlier you have some viruses in childhood, the better your immune tolerance is later in life. And there's a period of quote unquote training the immune system when you're little. We don't want to put our kids in a bubble. In fact, what we saw during the pandemic is those kids that were young and spent 2 years inside, they finally all went back to preschool or daycare and they got sick every month. And they were just had the opportunity for exposure. So it's been a couple of hard years with infections for kids, but most of them did really well, didn't end up in the hospital, didn't die. They were very resilient from it. And we can't protect ourselves from infection forever and ever. It's going to happen. We're going to get viruses. We're going to get COVID. We're going to get the flu. We're going to, you know, hopefully not get strep throat as adults over and over, but children certainly do. And then we're going to possibly eat some contaminated food or drink some contaminated water and get a protozoal infection. So, and I would argue that some environmental toxicants are like infections for our body as well. So it's not if we're going to get infected, it's how we handle and regulate those infections once we have been exposed.
I think that's really helpful to hear because, you know, there's this balance between avoidance and, you know, resilience, or sometimes I don't like that word, but the avoidance and then just kind of putting yourself into the world and supporting the body's response to these threats. So I really like that you framed that, you know, we're all going to be exposed to these viruses, bacteria, protozoa over time. And, you know, that it's about helping the body deal with them, right?
Exactly. And some people have rare things like hypogammaglobulinemia, where their innate immune systems are low and they have low IgA and IgG and IgM, but that's real. And those are immune molecules that help to regulate infection. It's not as uncommon to have IgA deficiency where your immune system doesn't have as much IgA. In fact, if you have an Epstein-Barr virus that is pretty acute, it can actually diminish all of your IgA. You can do a serum study and see that someone doesn't have any IgA at all. But it's not innate. It wasn't inheritable that they're dealing with. So our immunoglobulins fluctuate based on exposures. And some of us are born with less than others, but that can your body can adapt over time.
Yeah. I'm glad you bring that up because I think, you know, that's often something that is checked later when someone's not responding like we would expect, right? So, you know, find out that, oh, they're just chronically low in IgG or IgA. Is that sort of how it's typically found out? Is just more of the more complex cases, or is it starting to be screened earlier?
In my practice, it depends on the history, because if you're a kiddo that's had lots of ear infections, chronic sinus infections, I'm going to check it way earlier. And there are things that you can do about it. I mean, in severe cases, people get infusions called IVIG, which is a immunoglobulin infusion. And sometimes that's the one therapy that helps a kid with an autoimmune encephalitis in the brain come back to homeostasis. But there's also immunoglobulin you can put in the gut from cow blood called Immunolin. That's my second favorite immunoglobulin. Well, it's my first actually, because I used to do IVIG with kids, and I'm now just really referring to the rheumatologists that have infusion centers if they need it. But you can put it into your gut, which those immunoglobulins will go to work for you despite knowing anything about the gut, any type of bacteria, any type of protozoa. So we can ingest them. You can take certain probiotics like Saccharomyces boulardii to increase the amount of IgA in your mucus, right, in your gut epithelium. So there are some interventions that we can do. But I would really want to say this to all parents too, because in this work, I don't know if you found this, but you know, sometimes our patients are so afraid of any medication at all because, you know, of the corruption of big pharma and all the influences that we all have to reckon with and reconcile with. Mm-hmm. However, not every medication is evil. And if your child has strep throat, please don't ever not treat it, because group hemolytic strep can actually, you know, it can affect the heart. It can definitely affect your brain. It's really, really dangerous if you have an acute strep infection and you don't heal it. Now, when it comes to the gut and having infection, I think that there are some good things that we can use that are not antibiotics to balance the gut.
Right.
What's your favorite go-to when it comes to like bacterial dysbiosis and balancing gut flora? Do you have a go-to?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a judgment that I always make about how stable the person is. And so sometimes I'll spend time just supporting and stabilizing a little bit. But when it comes to purely antimicrobial herbals, I'm a big fan of oregano oil, also clove oil, berberine. Those are usually really good. Berberine's a bigger kind of gun. I hate to use that word, but yeah, it's a bigger kind of stronger medicine than we think. So you kind of have to, with that one, I'm a little bit more cautious, but oregano and clove do wonders. And, you know, especially you get them in the soft gel form and stabilized so that they don't irritate the stomach.
Yes. And hopefully your patients can swallow pills so they don't have to actually.
Yeah. Tinctures, you can use tinctures along. Yeah, right. That's true. There's also tinctures for people who, you know, can't, for kids who don't do pills yet or what have you. But yeah, it's really interesting. I'd love to kind of take this moment and ask you something that just came up while you were talking, is that, so there's someone I learned from that has a Perry Nicholson. He has this, program called Stop Chasing Pain. And I'm always wondering if someone's going to come out with this motto within this world of neuroinflammation and of stop chasing infections. I'm wondering if that's ever going to kind of come about, like where the focus isn't so much on like finding the bug and killing it versus doing more balancing and helping the immune system deal with these threats. What do you think about that? Are we approaching an era where we can shift out of just like the stop chasing infection mode? I'm sorry, the chasing infection mode.
Yes, I hear exactly what you're saying. And it's really a very thought-provoking and interesting question. I think that if you have an extremely acutely ill patient, like someone that has lobular pneumonia and a fever of 104 and their O2 sats are less than 90, you need to give them that IV ceftriaxone.
Yeah.
IV antibiotics to get them to where they're able to function. But if it's a, you know, somebody with depression that seems to have chronic gut dysbiosis, to me, it's about, well, how can we shift the flora in a positive way? How can we get more flora that's good to outcompete the bad? and what, how can we increase your immune resilience so you're not so vulnerable to continue to pick up one infection after the next? So it's a really interesting question. I think that set and setting, depending on who the patient is and what the scenario is, would really lean into, you know, what is the most appropriate thing at that time. But I hear you. Mm-hmm. In the integrative world, we've gone from, okay, so what antibiotic can we use to what herbal can we use to kill this? And I don't know if you saw Doctor's Data. It's a lab that I use. I'm not sure if you use Doctor's Data. They put that, they called it an antibiotogram. Mm. And they took all of their stool studies and they showed, because they do a culture and sensitivity with both medications and herbs. And they did it and they said profoundly, if you look at that list, I thought it was so brilliant that they gave it to us, that depending on the flora that they found, like Klebsiella pneumoniae or Clostridia, what was the agent that worked the best in most patients?
Yeah.
And grapefruit seed extract won.
It won. Yeah.
It won. However, if you look at grapefruit seed extract, you got to be real careful about what right. kind you use, because some of them are not active at all.
So. Yeah. And, you know, it's also very broad spectrum. So it's going to take down a lot of things with it. And so, yeah, it's, I think it'll be good for us to kind of realize we have those tools and learn when to use them appropriately, but not overuse them, because we can just fall right into the trap of, you know, overusing antibiotics, call it an herb, call it a med. It's, yeah. it's, you know,
whack-a-mole.
Yeah. I mean, there are some benefits to the herbal medicines that we don't see with antibiotics. So like a number of them, like clove, is actually a prebiotic. And, I did a ranking of the list of prebiotics. It's actually, I think, one of the, richest polyphenols there is. And so we do get other benefits, right, for using herbs for this purpose. Like some of them are anti-inflammatory, some of them are prebiotic or polyphenol rich, so they're not just antimicrobial in nature. So it's nice to know that we're, you know, providing other support with these herbs. But yeah, it'll be just interesting to see, like you're saying, is if we get to a point where, you know, sometimes for these conditions we're boosting the immune system and boosting the defense versus just kind of taking down the threat. It's more of like a terrain approach, I guess.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. And immune activation and mental health, I mean, just to kind of recap a little bit of where we've been, is, you know, the gut plays a role because of the bacteria, the translocation. We see this definitely, the immune system playing a role in health with Pan's Pandas, as I was talking a little bit about before. And inflammation, you know, some of the players that cross through the brain, those inflammation molecules, tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukin 6, they can play a role in pathogenesis, and it has a lot to do with what happens in the brain after it becomes inflamed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what are your specialties? Is Pans, Pandas, your kind of organization of these conditions, because I think a lot of people get confused. We've had a couple other podcasts that discuss Pan and Pandas, but can you walk us through how this is sort of a, I would say, model for us to really understand the immune system and mental health?
Yes, I think it's a really striking example. And I know this discussion isn't about Pan's Pandas, so I'll be really brief. But in a nutshell, when a child's behavior suddenly changes, you can, they usually have a basket or a manifestation of some symptoms like OCD, restrictive eating, behavioral regulation problems, deterioration in school performance, even urinary problems like frequency or bedwetting. And it's like parents say, you know, what happened to my child? They were happy, healthy, doing well. And then all of a sudden we have all these problems. And mm-hmm. a lot of times those kids have gotten an infection that hasn't been treated. And the inflammation from the infection has made their brain have inflammation in the basal ganglia. So they have a variety of different symptoms that they're dealing with. And I put on this slide also, this happens in kids with autism. And unfortunately, what happens in autism is they think, oh, their autism got worse. Mm-hmm. And autism usually doesn't get worse once you have your initial presentation of it. Everybody has good or bad days. But if you have a regression, if you're doing things like you're stimming more or you're not having any more developmental gains, maybe you've lost some, you have a lot of aggression, you're no longer sleeping. These kids with autism get people don't think a lot about infection in them. They just say, oh, it's their autism. But I would argue that point, that it's physiological stress on them, likely on their immune system, that it's infecting the way that their brain is functioning.
Yeah, so helpful to hear that and understand it, because you know, coming from an immune system centric point of view, then, you know, it helps you kind of figure out how to help this child balance, right?
They don't need more antipsychotic medication. They might need, you know, they might need some anti-inflammatories. They might need an antibiotic. They might need you to go on the hunt to see where the infection is, just even a simple, you know, throat culture and swab at the pediatrician. Mm-hmm. And another striking example of this, of the immune system in the brain, is there is something actually, I don't know if you've ever heard of it before. I've recently learned about it in the past year, called regressive Down syndrome. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
So it's a child that has Down syndrome that all of a sudden has worsening of their Down syndrome. Sounds familiar, right? Like worsening of their autism. Well, what they're finding out is they give these kids IVIG and it normalizes them.
Wow.
Right?
Amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, it's
so helpful, because it's just such a helpless state for the child, or, you know, even an older, like an adult with autism, or teen with autism, or adult with Down syndrome, et cetera, where they're, you know, they're making progress, maybe doing more activities, and then to have a setback, and just to know that this is an area to look into first.
Right. And I'm so excited for some of the research that's been done in regressive, a child that has regressive milestones, say they're happy, healthy, going along at 2 to 3 years old, they have a regression. Well, there has been some case studies where they've given those children IVIG and it normalized their development. So they were never diagnosed with autism because it normalized their development. And for the listeners that don't know what IVIG is, it's that blood infusion you get, and it's immunoglobulins that are from thousands and thousands of people. So it's like rescuing your immune system from whatever is burdening it. And IVIG can save lives for sure. We usually give it in the hospital, but you can give it in the outpatient setting. And it's one of the most significant therapies. It's extremely expensive. You don't do it lightly. But I just bring it up to show the role of even the immune system in developmental delay in autism. You know, I'd love to see a study someday where we take a cohort of kids and we give them IVIG right away when they regress. And wouldn't that be amazing if they all no longer had an autism diagnosis, or they got their milestones back?
Yeah, yeah. And IVIG is, you know, again, another major topic of that deserves like a lot of discussion, and, you know, like a podcast kind of. There's a lot of good information about it in pediatrics, though. So it's, you know, there's a lot of great info for parents out there to learn about it.
Yes. And one thing that we haven't talked about yet that is probably central to my thinking in disorders is glutamate. So when the brain is inflamed, it causes activation of our immune cells called the microglia. And the inflammation that we see again is around these cytokines, these inflammatory things like tumor necrosis factor, interleukin 6, sometimes interferon. They all have too much glutamate. So glutamate is one of our excitatory neurotransmitters, but it's by far our most abundant neurotransmitter in our brain. And you can get something in your brain called glutamate excitotoxicity. So when glutamate is excited, so the microglial dump out glutamate, some people have genetic predisposition not to do well with regulation of glutamate at baseline because they have variants in those pathways. But as your glia is dumping out glutamate, typically your astrocytes basically help to bring in the glutamate, so do your excitatory amino acid transporters. These are mechanisms to clear and regulate glutamate, but when there's consistent activation of the microglia and it's not cleared, there becomes an aberrant response. And what happens is we can remodel the brain. So instead of being in that pre-postsynaptic excitation, the brain can really be stuck with high glutamate in postsynaptic excitation. And the astrocytes atrophy, the amino acid transfers aren't working, and there's this prolonged amount of inflammation. And there was a study done, I think it's on this reference slide. It's one of my favorite. It's literally, I think maybe if you go one or two more, it was a study done by the National Institute of Mental Health and really a provider at Emory, one of the physicians. Yeah, it must be on the, if we go back.
I see Haroon and yeah. Miller.
Yes, yes. I don't know, for you guys that really want to geek out on neuroscience, this is really one of my favorite articles I've ever read. They're from Emory University School of Medicine, and they collaborated with the National Institute of Mental Health. And it's really a synopsis of what we've learned about how glutamate can remodel the brain and its role in mental health. I had to read it two or three times to grasp all of it. And I will confess, I fell asleep a few times because it's soothing when you're reading it. But it's it just really is. I find this to be so true clinically. And it's good to see.
Yeah. And, you know, I think also we're getting some data back on some organic acid tests that can kind of lead us to some crumbs of clues that glutamate is excessive. I mean, it's definitely not a home run for sure test, but, you know, that I always am, I find it somewhat helpful. And then we have some tools to help stabilize neuroinflammation and support these pathways, which is exciting.
Yes. And you must be talking about quinolinic acid, correct?
Yeah, that's the one that that will give me a clue that glutamate might be going a little wild in the brain.
Yes. Well, you can see they even talk about quinolinic acid in this article, which I was very excited
that's good.
To hear about.
Yeah. So, that's great.
Yes. And yes, there are agents to remodel the brain that are helpful for lowering glutamate for sure. That picture on the screen is a visual of presynaptic microglial and glutamate toxicity, and then over time in the later stage, how it can remodel the brain and keep you in this excitatory, excessive glutamate place. So I thought it was a really good picture. If you want to, you know, dial into it, you can see all the little interleukins and the astrocytes, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if we're going to simplify it, so I know we talked a lot about a lot of big things. So let's simplify it for the listeners. The truth is we all have a genetic predisposition. We all have a genetic vulnerability. And you guys know that, you know, depression runs in our family, or schizophrenia or Parkinson's or neurodevelopmental delay or decline can run in families. We are all have our own N of one with genetics for sure. We all come into this world very uniquely. And then how we feed our bodies from the very beginning to the very end really makes a big difference in our immunity. And our gut plays a big role with inflammation and dysbiosis, especially when we have dysbiosis and we have a lot of lipopolysaccharides or those high inflammatory molecules that agitate the gut lining. And then we're all going to be exposed to infection, but is it under-recognized or is it poorly treated or is it the terrain that needs some help? And then if those things aren't adequately really addressed, you can have this aberrant inflammation. So inflammation in the brain, the microglia, all those inflammation molecules we talked about. And with more inflammation, you have more glutamate, and you can have more glutamate excitotoxicity in the brain, which eventually can lead to remodeling. So my job for my patients and your job for you is to try to control the terrain as best as you can. And as providers, we can tell you things to do and not to do. But honestly, what you decide to do is what's going to make the biggest difference.
Yeah.
Your daily decisions.
Right. And I think also using your provider to establish the priorities so that, you know, you don't have a million things going at once. I see a lot of people who will pick up books and podcasts and, you know, information, you know, from reading. And I mean, I've been a medical parent, you know, so I know what it's like where you're like up all night looking for answers and bringing that back to the provider and saying, you know what, where should I start with all this? All of it seems reasonable at some point or at some place, but it's always helpful to have someone who, we call it, one of my really good friends calls it someone who can stay above the water and just
There's nothing more that'll keep you up at night when you have a sick child, you know, doctor Googling, looking for the best answer. And then when you know the keywords to put into the browser, it can get really, really tough as a parent.
Yeah, especially now with ChatGPT, it's like, okay, now you have a Google bestie. It's like...
Oh, no, I haven't gone down that path yet.
So oh, good. Yeah, I mean, there's some really cool stuff for reading research papers, which I am, like, a big fan of. But as far as, like, the general ChatGPT, it's really good for, like, basic information, but it can also just make you feel stuck.
That is a vulnerability for sure, especially being a healthcare provider. The more you know, the more you realize you don't know if you're really, really searching. And the more it just kind of leaves you vulnerable because you think about all the possibilities that it could be for you or your child or your loved one. It can be a real vulnerable place to be, yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
So we can do things, you know, we can increase our baseline resilience. We can optimize our nutrition, our diet. We can pay attention to the gut. We can treat infections when they come. We can try to decrease the toxicity in our environment. We can work on trying to regulate our inflammation, which all those prior steps help with inflammation. We can work on glutamate modulation or trying to downregulate it. And we can support neurotransmission. And what I think is really, really important to say is when you're trying to get unstuck from this glutamate load, if you think about the example of ketamine, you know, ketamine is our most powerful glutamate modulator we have. Other than there are some other outpatient medications like amantadine and memantine, those actually can work really well as well. But really, like, very powerful glutamate modulation is ketamine. And we know about 30% of people that do ketamine for depression, can cure their depression. However, if you do ketamine-assisted psychotherapy or you put a therapist with it, your recovery rate's about 80%. It almost doubles. And that's because you're not stuck in those pathways, that aberrant thinking pathway, that loop, that groove. You're able to free yourself, dissociate from it, and start to rework how you're thinking about, you know, your thought patterns and how your brain is stuck in places that are dark and not serving you. So therapy is so important. but it's important to help you remodel your brain physiologically. And I think that can get lost.
Well, it's so great. And I think knowing, being linked up with therapists that understand neuroplasticity and those pathways would be really helpful if there was some kind of organization that you could refer us to that oversees that. That would be really helpful because I think a lot of people are open to learning more about that.
I know the Integrative Psychiatric Institute in Boulder actually is doing some training of providers for ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. It's kind of a buzzword lately because everybody's getting really excited about the potential and the help that you can have. And really, it comes down to glutamate modulation. So it really is an underpinning for this talk about how does glutamate become aberrant? What's all the upstream things for it? And there are supplements. I mean, there are supplements. N-acetylcysteine in particular, or NAC. Giving higher doses of NAC helps the microglia not dump out so much glutamate into the brain. That's the mechanism that it works.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But doses of NAC matter. You know, we're talking 2,400 milligrams to 3,000 milligrams a day. People woefully underdose it. Other things like magnesium threonate can cross through the blood-brain barrier, has some glutamate modulation, so does taurine. And then, you know, sometimes increasing GABA can help too, giving enough activated B6, giving some L-theanine. So we do have some supplements that can be helpful if dosed at the right time and the right dosing for the right patient and indication. It can be helpful. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, people knowing which agents, like you've just mentioned, can actually get through the blood-brain barrier is really helpful. And also quality too, like the, you know, the brands that you select and the supplements that you use to make sure that, you know, you're getting what you're purchasing is all, because a lot of times people will say, well, I tried that, or I tried this, or tried that. Did you dose it correctly? Maybe, maybe not. Did you use a quality brand? Was it batch, you know, was the batch what it said it is? So all these factors really play a role. So I always think, like, if you're starting on this journey and working with someone, even if you've tried something, really listen to the provider's selection of nutrients and dosing before, and you might have to reapproach it and try it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're speaking of the fancy word pharmacovigilance in the supplement world. And, you know, we have Neuronutrients as our supplement company, and I can tell you it is the Wild West out there, even in the United States. So quality is really important, and some people just test the batch. They don't do every batch that's manufactured, and then what are you sourcing? But being a consumer that has a really critical eye is very important. If you're trying to treat something and you're trying to take it for health, you do want to know that what you think you're getting, you're actually getting. And things like even, say, saffron, you know, Crocus sativus is known to be a natural SSRI. It has really exciting research around blood-brain barrier permeability, helping with serotonin synthesis. But what's the extract? How much is the extract? Like, is it 0.3? Is it 2%? Is it a branded form? Like, you gotta, in order for efficacy, you gotta really dial in and know what you're getting, especially with your Bs. We could talk another hour about B vitamins. So I know we're about running out of time, so we can stop.
Yeah, before I completely let us off the hook, I love Immunolin. So I would just kind of love for you just to talk a little about that, because it's just been such a great addition to our therapeutic tool chest.
I love it too, because it's immunoglobulins. So we're not having to get it IV. We're getting it from cow blood. It's dried into a powder. Immunolin is actually the trademark. So you'll see any product really on the market, they're the only ones that make it. And Terra Health makes it. It is serum-derived bovine immunoglobulin. It has lots of IgG in it, a little bit of IgA and a little bit of IgM. but it just goes to work for you. It's a powder you put into your gut. And if you have gram-negative bacteria, if you have high lipopolysaccharides, if you have SIBO or SIFO, if you have tight junction issues, I mean, it's really, it's pleiotrophic. It has so many different roles. And guess mm-hmm. what? Excellent source of protein. So, you know,
yeah.
1 gram of immunolin is 1 gram of protein. So it works really, really well. We created a product called Balance Gut Support. And I have been prescribing immunolin, which is in the form of Interagam. It's the prescriptive mm-hmm. form because it's a little bit higher of a dose. And I just really love the company. And they sell it to some manufacturers out there. You can get their product. So that if I'm going to make a gut product, you know, I don't know what probiotics people need, but I certainly know that most of us need a little immunoglobulin from time to time. And I put some prebiotic fiber in there as well, because that helps us to thrive the beneficial flora, you know, the good bugs, to change the terrain. So I mm-hmm. should call it Terrain Changer now that we've had this.
There we go. That's good. Yeah. Well, this has been really fun and amazing to go through this journey with you and kind of get your view and the way you see the mental health and the immune system interfacing. So thank you so much for all this. I'd love just to kind of get some closing thoughts and then just hear how you like people to follow your work and how they can kind of keep up with some of your companies and the things that you're involved with.
Well, first of all, thank you for asking me to be on the podcast. I always like to geek out with other providers that know a little bit about this. And clearly yeah. you're one of the experts. So I appreciate you having me on. You can find me at Neuronutrients. I'm always, I'm trying to blog pretty often. Anything that I have on there has a monograph, which it has peer reviewed references. And, I'm very meticulously detailed about why I did what I did and what quality is in things. So you can find me there. You can find me on Instagram for Neuronutrition Associates. We also have an Instagram for Neuronutrients, but I seem to do a few podcasts every now and then. I'll definitely be posting those on either platform. And my practice is Neuronutrition Associates, and I'm in Austin, Texas. So I have a health coach that just started that's taking patients. I still am taking patients. I have a little bit of a wait list, so you might have to wait to get in to see me. But I have my health coach can do a lot before you get into the door to see me as well. So that's always a good beginning.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, you're so understated about how much you're influencing all of us and helping so many children and families. I mean, I think you're a beacon of hope for people to really get good information and simplify it. And like you said, with your especially translate the information into action and into clinical results. So it's been really helpful because I know the population of neurodiverse population is just needing something solid, you know, because there's so much information and some of it's very confusing. And thank you. So thank you for all that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much. It takes a village. It takes the patient, the provider. It takes a village. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of the One Thing Podcast. Please share these episodes with your friends, loved ones, colleagues, patients, healthcare providers, anyone who you feel might benefit from hearing these informative interviews. We tend to learn best from people sharing things with us. That's often the first time it's introduced. So don't hesitate if the content of these episodes reminded you of someone that might benefit from it. Forward the episode to them, and I'm sure they'll either appreciate it or be appreciative that you've thought of them. So once again, we'll look forward to seeing you next episode on the One Thing Podcast. And again, much appreciation for you being here with me.